The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. So, perhaps we can start with a little bit louder. Is that good? They're good? Okay, so it's always strange, you know, I stop talking to listen to see if it's loud enough, and that doesn't work. Anybody would like to bring any questions up or some reports about how the meditation is going at home or questions about the instructions so far or anything you'd like to bring up? So here, Smita, here in the front.
So after the classes I've attended, I've tried to be mindful, not just during meditation, but during different times in the day. And then my mind tries to trick me by saying, you really don't need to do have a meditation. You, as long as you're mindful throughout the day, you're fine. So there's a part of me that wants to meditate, and then a part of me that resists, you know, sitting or meditation. So
you've started to practice mindfulness throughout the day, and
you
find that meaningful and helpful for you.
Exactly.
It's nice.
It's nice.
What way is it helpful for you?
Number one, I have more energy. I sleep less. People around me like me more. it's been very beneficial. So on the second era concept, I think my kids especially feel like I'm a better mother. Uh-huh. And I try to tell my 13-year-old son about it. And he didn't print out his homework the night before. And I would have yelled and screamed and, you know, how couldn't you be like this? You're 13 years old, you're in 8th grade, you should know better, blah, blah, blah. And but then I told him, this is the first arrow that you didn't get your homework printed out last night, so let's not throw more arrows at us. Let's see how it could be done. He loves it. So
great. Lovely. And so then the question is, So some voice inside of you is saying that, well, this is working great in daily life.
Yeah.
So who needs meditation?
Why do you have to sit then?
That just adds more stress to your life, right? You have to find the time for it, and you have a busy life, and, you know, who has time for meditation?
Right.
I've found sometimes that when I felt like I have too much to do, a lot of things to do, that's the best time to meditate. And it seems kind of counterintuitive, because you seem like, well, how could you stop to taking care of things, because you have this long, I have this long list. But what happens afterwards, I seem to have a lot more time. Because time is a little bit in here, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, to answer, it's a reasonable question. And I've known some people who have decided not to meditate because they were going to rely on practicing in daily life. And they were a little bit fooling themselves. And so what I tell people sometimes, it's a fine thing to do, but every once in a while you should test yourself. And then try for a few days to meditate every day and see what the difference is, see what gets revealed. And sooner, you know, you might discover by meditating a few days, but actually it's going well, but you could actually be a lot better. There's a whole areas of your life you're not really addressing and whole levels of calm that you're not really accessing. Whole degree of mental chatter, which is quietly going on in the background, which you're contentedly living with when you're practicing daily life, that's really good to put to rest periodically. So test it every once in a while. But I think what's more interesting, I think, is that in doing mindfulness practice, I think it's helpful to follow your heart. Follow where it's beneficial. Follow where you find value in it. And if where you find value is in daily life, follow that and do it. And if you don't find any value at all in sitting and meditating, don't do it. But if you find value there, then, you know, follow the value, follow what's beneficial. But do periodically test yourself, or, you know, every, you know, few months, try sitting for a week and see. Does anybody else would like to ask anything? In the back there. Smita will.
Uh, One thing I've really noticed is that my mind is really busy, and from what I've heard other people say, that's not unusual. But what I've found really useful, it's been kind of a revelation, is how busy my mind is. I'm really aware of it now. In fact, it's almost a curse. It's like I have to watch the double-edged sword, because before I might not have been, I mean the second arrow, because before I wasn't always aware of how my thoughts were just, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but my area seems to be the thoughts is where I get lost. I get off and lots of planning, you know. I can be planning tomorrow, next week, a month from now. And but now I'm become more aware
that you're doing it.
And I guess my question is, I'm hopeful that becoming aware and continuing the practice, it may change. You know, that's what I'm hopeful of. It made me think of something I read or heard. I may have heard it here, I'm not sure, but back in the 60s, the mantra was be here now. But now with all cell phones and iPhones and texting, and the mantra is more be somewhere else now. So, and that's what my brain seems to be continually trying to pull me off, to be somewhere else now. So,
it is, you know, in our circles we say it's really good to see it, see how this operates. Because if you don't see how your mind operates, you're not really in charge. And so something else is in charge. And sometimes it's not necessarily to your best interest to have your unattended mind in charge. It's like, you know, turning your house over to a bunch of teenagers. You know, sometimes it's okay. But, you know, it's often good to have a parent nearby. So I believe that just being mindful of it all, you can start taking some responsibility for it. You see what's going on. You can decide sometimes this is not useful, and you can maybe let go of it. You're having a conversation with a friend, and now you're more likely to notice that you're off planning your meal later in the day. So I'm not really there for my friend. So you see that tendency, and so maybe you can pull back at that moment and be there for that your friend. So you have more choice, and you kind of can track and adjust because of that new information. You might also start learning what's going on in a deeper way. So when I talked about how many people plan, I mentioned that high percentage of planners the planning is fueled by anxiety or fear. And so that's interesting information. So then you would bring your mindfulness to that, the emotions, and see if in being mindful of the emotions, if the emotions can either not have their charge anymore, have their hook anymore for us, we're not pushed around by them, or maybe they can relax and settle down. And then that's more profound than it is to stop the thinking mind, because so you can learn about it. An interesting question to ask for yourself, in that you do all this planning and planning and planning, is to step back sometime, maybe have a cup of tea and think about this a little bit, and consider what is the cost to you for spending so much time planning? What's the cost? What's the loss? And so that might, you know, it might be interesting to actually take that in. And if you really see that, then you might start becoming, or your mind might start becoming, this is a very significant Buddhist word, you might start becoming disenchanted with the enchantment of all the planning, what the planning's going to do. And the mind is often quite enchanted that, you know, in its ideas, its stories, its memories, its fantasies. And partly it's enchanted because we think that there's magic there. There's something, it'll do something for us. And to start getting disenchanted with the trance is considered very healthy. But disenchanted in the sense that you were kind of like caught in the magic web. And not disenchanted in the sense of being kind of, you know, becoming a dull person, but or unexcited by things, but you're no longer in a trance. Anything else? Yes, please.
I had been practicing almost every single day and just feeling very motivated to do it and enjoying the practice so much. And last Saturday, I had a moment where I felt a very strong emotion. I can't remember now if it was fear or anger, or maybe it was both. And for the first time, I didn't feel like I had to say why, ask any questions. I just felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And then breathe through it. Just breathe. And it felt so good and peaceful. I haven't practiced since. And I don't really understand. I have not been able to sit since. And I could have come on Monday if it hadn't been Halloween. I would have been here. But I'm curious about that. If you have any thoughts about that.
Sometimes something significant can happen in meditation. And it's somehow that sometimes people have the intuitive or unconscious feeling that in order to integrate that into or digest it properly, maybe it's better to step away from the meditation for a while and let it kind of do something. That's part of it. That's sometimes. Sometimes, as we meditate and get settled, calm, the busyness of the mind is sometimes a lid on top of wellsprings of emotions, unresolved issues in our lives. And so sometimes you get quiet enough and you're minding your own business, quiet and calm, and then something unexpected bubbles up. It's quite strong, like an emotional storm or something. And because it's been there waiting for a long time, finally get a chance. So it's possible that you touched such a place and you did the practice in a beautiful way, but maybe part of you is afraid to go there again. Because, you know, if you do go there again, you might have to face that again. And maybe there's still something. It was nice that it resolved so quickly, but something might still be lingering there. And so there's a hesitation, a little bit of fear to go back to that place. That also can happen to people. But I would take it as a very good sign. I think it speaks really well for how you understand the practice, that you were able to not ask why, not get involved in the thoughts around it, just be present for it as it is. And it's remarkable how many really strong, difficult emotions resolve themselves quickly if we don't get pulled into the story, but just are present for them in a very clear, full way.
So to take a few days off is okay. Is there any advice you have for getting myself to practice again?
I thought your idea of coming here or sitting with a group of people and kind of getting a little jump start is good. So maybe sitting tonight will be a little bit of a jump start. So that's one thing. The other thing is I have a friend of mine who's a teacher that he gives this teaching to people. He said you should every day, if it's hard for you to sit, every day commit yourself to get into the meditation posture. At least get into the posture. And then the chances are, once you're in the meditation posture, you're probably not just going to pop up and do something else. Then probably you're going to linger a little bit. And once you linger a little bit, then you're more likely to continue.
Thank you.
Okay. So, before we do a meditation session, I want to say that this whole path of meditation, mindfulness meditation, is in some ways an individual journey, and everyone's going to have a different way that it unfolds. So there's not like, you know, this is the right way and it's supposed to unfold. One of the common ideas that some people have is that sooner or later your mind's going to quiet down, you'll have a quiet mind, you won't think a lot. But in fact, it does happen to some people that way, and it's meaningful when it can happen. But I've known people who've been meditating for 20, 30 years, and they say, my mind's always chattering. And I know one friend of mine who says, I've been meditating for 30 years, and all these people talk about deep calm and settledness and all these wonderful things that happen in meditation. Nothing happens to me in meditation. And my mind talks away and chatters, and nothing happens. And but afterwards, the rest of my day is dramatically different. That's where the benefits are. So for her, meditation itself doesn't have so-called meditation benefits. But the fact that she's practicing mindfulness, it spills over and has a hugely important part of her life. And when she stops meditating, she feels the difference. So the fact that maybe your mind stays busy doesn't mean that it's a failure. It just means that you're practicing with a busy mind. That's you know, and so you practice with that and do your best you can. Some people, you know, have strong emotions, and that becomes a regular part of their meditation practice. That's not right or wrong, it's just your way. So so I like to think of this meditation practice as being very accepting of who you are. You don't have to fit yourself into some other people's idea of what's supposed to happen. What it is it's very respectful in that way, but then in that respect, as I think I said earlier, means respect literally means to look again in Latin. So it's really to take a deeper look. Let me be present here. And in taking a deeper look, learning how to be wise and present, how not to add second arrows to what's going on. And so meditation can be different things for different people, how it unfolds. And there's different approaches to meditation at different points in a person's life or in different situations. Sometimes meditation, I remember one teacher many years ago who said, sometimes a successful period of meditation, the measure of success is that you didn't leave your seat. Because he said, sometimes it's like the rodeo, because there can be so much restlessness, so much agitation, so much difficulty that comes up, that the fact that you didn't move, you know, and you broke out in a sweat trying to not move, that's successful. You didn't give in. And sometimes you have to be, you know, the powers of the mind are so strong that you have to really apply yourself strongly. Don't go into the mind. Don't get lost or something. Don't give in to a strong desire. Don't give in to something. Other times meditation is much more about relaxing and letting go and being soft and gentle. Sometimes it's a more active process. Sometimes it's a more receptive and passive process. There's not one way to do it. And so at different times in our life, different situations, it might feel more active, and other times it's more passive. So, you know, you've been sued and you're in court, and that no good lousy person sitting on the other side of the courtroom who's accusing you for things you didn't do, and it looks like the case is not going in your favor, and they say one more thing about, terrible thing about you, and you're sitting there and you think, this is a good time to meditate. And it's heroic to sit still in your chair in the courthouse and not get up and do something to that fella. It's heroic, and you take all, it takes all your mindfulness and strength and to stay present, and not give in. And it's a hard work because the forces inside are so strong. Other times, you wake up in the morning, you're relaxed and peaceful, and you know you don't to make a lot of effort is to. You know, is to use too big of a tool for something that's really refined. So it just kind of makes you more agitated. So then you have to learn how to be very soft and gentle and tender and very calm in your meditation and receptive. So in different times, there's different approaches. So in your handout, there's a description of one approach, which is much more the receptive approach to meditation, to relax and let things come to you. Don't try so hard. And so the analogy that's given in Buddhism for a human being sometimes, so a human being is like a one-room cottage. And the one-room cottage has five windows and a door. And those five windows and doors represent the five senses and the sixth sense in Buddhism, which is a sense that lets us know what's going on in the mind. So the sixth sense doors in Buddhism. And in that one-room cottage, there is an easy chair, nice recliner, and that's where you sit. And you sit there and be relaxed, and you notice what comes, and the windows and the doors are open, and you notice what arises in the window and the door. A squirrel jumps up on the windowsill, and you just watch the squirrel run and go away. A local cat comes sniffing at the door. You see the cat come and go. You see some interesting animal out in the yard, and you just watch it going. But you don't leave your chair to go out in the yard to go after it. You don't try to, you know, chase away the raccoons. You don't try to bring the cat in the house. You just sit and watch what arises and passes and occurs in the window and the door. But you stay in your chair. So in the same way, in meditation, we take an easy seat, we take our relaxed kind of stance in the mind, and we don't go out and we don't pull away. We just notice what arises, what comes on its own at the different sense doors where we can experience things directly. And sometimes there's an itch, and we just feel the itch. Sometimes there's a sound outside, sometimes there's a breath, sometimes there's a thought. And whatever it is that appears, we just recognize it and see it for what it is without doing anything with it, either towards it or pulling away from it. Just stay kind of relaxed about it. And this idea of staying relaxed no matter what happens is one of the great keys for letting meditation unfold. As soon as we get caught or concerned or preoccupied with what's happening, then the meditation, in a sense, has stopped. It's kind of coming back to this relaxed. Does it make some sense? So then, take a comfortable, alert meditation posture. Gently close your eyes. And then take a few moments to sway, rock your body back and forth, forward and back, and to help you kind of settle in and get yourself kind of into your body and established, and maybe a little bit looser in the spine. And giving some care to lining your vertebrae up on top of each other. And then to help you settle in, take a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you breathe in deeply, feel your torso, your ribcage expand like a massage from the inside. And as you exhale, soften and relax your body. And then letting your breathing return to normal. Take a few moments to scan through your body to see if there's any easy places that you can relax or soften in your body. Maybe starting up the forehead and the eyes. Relaxing the shoulders or softening around the shoulder blades. Perhaps softening a bit in your chest, around the heart. And then softening around the belly. Letting your stomach hang forward perhaps, loosening your pants if that helps. And it might be possible to soften some in your legs, in your thighs, relaxing, letting go, releasing any of the grip of the muscles around the bones. Also take a few moments to notice how you are now. Notice how you are in your body, how you are in your mind, how you are in your heart with your feelings. And if it's easy enough, set yourself at ease. Let yourself be easy, at ease in your body, at ease in your mind. Perhaps if you can let go of the thoughts and concerns of the day. And then become aware of your breathing. Your breathing has been your companion your whole life. Loyal, committed companion. Let yourself be aware of the rhythm of breathing in and out. Allow tuning into your breathing to help you let go of your thoughts and concerns, helping you to be present here and now. Letting go of your thoughts in favor of feeling your breathing, sensing it, being present for it. letting go of your thoughts so you can let go into your breathing. Perhaps getting closer or more intimate from the inside of the experience of breathing. And then staying alert enough to notice when other things arise that take you away from your breathing. If it's thoughts that take you away, then notice that clearly. Recognize that you're thinking a clear enough way that you're not lost in your thoughts, but that you're observing them. If emotions arise, feelings, in a relaxed way, recognize that you're feeling. Where the recognition is clear enough, distinct enough, that you're not caught up in or involved in whatever you're feeling. If there are compelling sensations in your body, then in a relaxed way, be mindful of those sensations. Relax, calm awareness of sensations in your body. And sometimes important thing to pay attention to is to notice if there's a strong attitude about what's happening or just a pervasive attitude that might be pulling you away from mindfulness, pulling you into its orbit of thoughts and feelings connected to the attitude. So if there's an attitude, clearly recognize it, be mindful of it. whenever possible, letting your breathing be your companion. Let your breathing be your connection to the present moment. And let the exhale be a reminder to let go of the simple thoughts that creep in. So we'll sit here one more minute. One more minute of being mindful of what's here. So meditation has many functions, and different times different functions are predominant. Certainly sometimes its function is to help us relax and de-stress. Sometimes its function is to help us to see much more clearly what's going on in us, how we operate, what our thoughts and beliefs and feelings are. To go deeper under the surface of our lives and kind of see deeper what's happening. Sometimes the purpose of mindfulness and meditation is to help us be more present for this life of ours. So as we go about in our life, we can be more present in, for our friends, our work, our family, so we have a more higher quality kind of connection and to this life of ours. Sometimes the purpose of meditation is to make some of the beautiful qualities of our hearts or inner life available more frequently. Things like compassion, creativity, joy, even things like kindness and friendship are much more accessible when we're not caught up and preoccupied and being really busy. So we relax. I think that having time for meditation is one of the ways that it's really important in this modern life where people tend to be very, very busy and often plugged into screens a lot. And there's something about the mind. I don't think our minds were made for this kind of hyper-fast life. And even though it can be pleasant and enjoyable and exciting to be plugged in and doing a lot of different things and racing around on the web or different things, it keeps the electrical circuits of the mind agitated, kind of firing very fast. And so it doesn't allow for the deeper settling and calming out of which I think a deeper sense of wisdom and understanding and connectedness can surface out of. So I believe that meditation has a really important function to return us to a little bit more of a natural state that's not so common in this society anymore. So what I've done, hopefully, in these weeks is to give you the basic instructions in mindfulness meditation. And some of it might have been a lot of instructions in this brief amount of time. If it felt like too much, then you can just rely on the first week's instructions for the next year. Sit up straight and be with your breath. The mind wanders off, come back to your breath. It's a long honor tradition back to the Buddha to use the breath meditation as a primary focus of meditation. And you can't go wrong. Just keep coming back, keeping it that simple. However, we also want to help us to become mindful of the full range of our human experience, not just learn how to be with our breath all the time. And so by learning to be mindful of our physical experience, mindful of emotional experience, mindful of our mental experience, then it's possible to become wiser about how we relate to that, how we operate in those realms. And so it's, in our tradition, it's very important at some point, to begin opening the attention up in meditation to be able to take in our physical experience, our mental experience, our emotional experience. So then over those first 4 weeks, especially, we talked about that. So if it seems like too much, the instructions, then keep it simple. It might be that's a week, a month, or sometime in the future, some of the instructions you got the third or fourth week maybe are more relevant than they are right now. So I offered you the basic instructions. So then the question some people like to ask is, how do I take this further? How do we go further with this? And there are two primary ways I like to talk about this. And one is that to practice this mindfulness in daily life, as you were talking about. And the other is to do the mindfulness practice together with more concentration. Concentration is a great aid and support for the mindfulness practice. If you do those two things, practice in daily life and bring more stability, concentration, focus to the mindfulness you're doing, then in Buddhist circles we say that leads to insight or to wisdom. And the cultivation of insight or wisdom is kind of one of the key aspects of this practice here. So I want to talk about these things. So practicing in daily life. So when I started meditating regularly in college, and at some point I was meditating twice a day, and it was nice for me. I enjoyed it. It felt good. And that didn't more than good. What kind of kept me going was I felt that in meditation I had more integrity than I had anywhere else in my life. That was the word I used myself. There's a sense of personal integrity, being whole, being honest, being completely here from here in some way. And so I would sit and meditate and feel this integrity, this wholeness, this connectedness. And then some point it dawned on me that the mind that I have in meditation is the same mind I have outside of meditation. Why was I only interested in integrity when I meditated? Shouldn't I be interested the rest of my life too? And so then I got very interested in how do I bring this practice, how do I bring the mindfulness into the rest of my life so that some of the benefits I received in meditation could be there as, in daily life as well. And, you know, it's kind of an arbitrary line, the activity of meditation and not meditation. So I kind of, in a way, did away with the line between them and tried to practice mindfulness in all situations I was in. And so I tried to practice mindfulness in conversation with other people. And as I started becoming more mindful of what goes on in conversations, some of it wasn't very exemplary in terms of what motivated me and what I was trying to do. And one of the first big shocks for me was how much I was trying to speak in such a way to manipulate the people I was talking to so they would think of me a certain way. They would see me a certain way. And I was kind of like, wow, you know. I have all these agendas. I'm not just giving, you know, giving them needed information. You know, I'm trying to make an impression. I'm trying to do something here. And so that I felt as I was kind of leaning or getting involved in that kind of conversation, I felt, oh, that's one of the places where I lost my integrity. And so I became aware of that by paying attention to my speech. And so there's a whole years and years of learning, of being mindful as I speak, being mindful of my body. So a lot your body will teach you as you're speaking. Your posture and your tension, how you hold yourself as you speak, is a big, big useful area of learning. What emotions are present as you speak? If you're not aware of what your emotions are as you speak, then the emotions sometimes will get the upper hand. And you'll say something that you regret you said afterwards. A saying that I come fond of is that it takes many, many years sometimes to develop a really good friend and 5 seconds to lose the friend. Just what you say, mindless speech sometimes. So be able to track how you're feeling and how that motivates what you speak. And then even more difficult, but also track what you're believing, what you're imagining, what you're projecting, what your thoughts are as you speak. It's a powerful, powerful area of mindfulness practice that will, you know, if that's all you did really well, maybe you don't need to meditate. Some people then will bring mindfulness into particular activities in a daily life. And some people find it very settling and calming to wash dishes, being mindful, not having the radio or TV on, or not being involved in conversations, not trying to do dishes as quickly as you can so you can go on to the important things of life. But to really do the dishes as if you're really going to be present, you're going to practice being mindfully, calmly present for this activity as completely and fully as you would be with your breath. The mind wanders off, you come back to the dishes. Mind wanders off, you come back. And some people find it's deeply, deeply settling to do this. I'll tell you a story. One of the great teachers in our tradition is a woman named Kamala Masters. She's from Hawaii. And when she got interested in meditation, she was a single mom with 4 kids. And she somehow or other was able to go on a meditation retreat with an Indian Vipassana teacher named Manindraji. I think in Hawaii he came to do a retreat. And at the end of the retreat, he said, it's really important to meditate every day. So then she went up to him and said, I can't meditate every day. And he said, everyone can find time to meditate every day. No, I can't. And so then she had the wherewithal to say, come and live with me for a few days. So he did. And after a couple of days of living with her and seeing her, you know, with 4 kids, and she had to work, the single mom, 4 kids, and all that, he said, you're right. So then he said, okay, well, I'll teach you what you can do instead. And he taught her, he went around with her as she went around the house and did things, and showed her how to do each different things mindfully. There was a hallway in the house that connected all the rooms in the house, so she was always going in the hallway. And so he said to her, this hallway, whenever you step into this hallway, this is hallways where you practice mindfulness of walking. walking meditation. And one of the handouts today is about walking meditation. And so every time she stepped in there, she let kind of, best she could, let go of her concerns and just was really present as the few steps she took in the hallway. And then he would get next to her in the sink and they wash dishes and show her how to wash dishes mindfully and clearly. And she started doing all the things she had to do in daily life, and she started doing it mindfully for a number of years until her kids were older. And then, when her kids were old enough, she went on a month-long retreat. And what was remarkable was that she hadn't done a lot of retreats, maybe one before, but because of these years of practicing in everyday life, when she went on a meditation retreat, she dropped really deep into deep meditation very, very quickly and became one of the really great mature practitioners and teachers in our tradition. And she attributes it to all the time she spent practicing daily life. So I hope that's an inspiring story. So some people then, you know, how do you practice in daily life? To say, well, now I'm going to practice all the time, mindful all the time, is too big of a task. So what some people do is they'll choose one task a week to be their mindfulness task. And then they change. So it could be that driving to work. You know, if you drive to work every day, then you turn off the radio or Pandora or whatever you do and just kind of keep both hands on the steering wheel and try to be really present for the experience of driving. And for a week, do that and see what benefits, what you learn, what goes on there. Maybe develop a little bit of a sense of what it feels like to be mindful driving. Or perhaps you park in your parking lot at work, and for a week you make the walking from your car to your office or your place of work as a mindfulness walking meditation practice. Or perhaps it's if you clean house. For 1 week, some of the basic tasks of cleaning the house, you'll do that mindfully. Mindfully means that's all you do while you're doing it. And try to be really present for it. Of course, the mind wanders away, but you bring it back to really be focused and be here for this activity. And so you choose different things. And over time, over the months that you do this, you'll develop a repertoire of different activities that you do that you have some sense of what it's like to be mindful in them. And it might become a little bit second nature to be a little bit more mindful doing those than you normally would. And you begin developing your capacity to be more mindful throughout the day. It's a beautiful thing to do. Some people will have mindfulness tricks to remind them, or cues. I've known people who've taken those little like circular stickies, like little tags or something, and put them on all the light switches in their home. And whenever they're going to turn on the light switches, see that little dot, and that reminds them, notice what's going on right now. Be mindful right now. I've used door frames whenever I've went through a door, because in the Zen tradition, you have to be very mindful because there's a particular choreographed way in which you walk through the door into the Zen meditation hall. And I adopted that as kind of a mindfulness cue for a long time. Whenever I walk through a door frame, it's kind of like you're walking into a new space. I would check in with myself, be mindful. How am I right now? And, you know, often I'm not in touch. You know, I'm busy kind of living my life, right? And it's really useful, instructive to discover how I'm feeling. A useful place to do this is with telephone calling, ringing. If those of you who still have telephones, use them. Or maybe if you get email and you hear the ping, if those of you have the ping that it comes on your computer. So some people have this instinct, maybe it's a deep reptilian instinct that we all have, a lot of us have, that when the telephone rings, you're supposed to answer it immediately, as quickly as you can. And fewer rings, the better. But actually, most people are patient enough to let it ring 5-6 times. So rather than answering the phone right away, use a few of those rings to check in with your breath, check in with yourself, see what's going on with you. Be mindful for a few moments. And that's really wise, because if you really have touched in, check in with yourself, really know how you are, and have the chance to relax a little bit, you probably have a better conversation on the phone. Same thing with those emails. You know, take a moment to breathe before you rush to read it and respond. So having different tasks and different kind of approaches like this in daily life can be very, very helpful, instructive. As people start having a little bit more sense of being mindful throughout the day, Like the lady here said, she was calmer, more present. Her kids liked her more. It also then benefits meditation. She said, you slept better too. So then we tend not to accumulate stress. We tend not to accumulate a lot of agitation in the mind when you stay more mindful through the day. You know, if you go on the driving, and you're not paying your attention to what's happening to you as you drive, you might not notice that the way you drive, there's a little bit of tension in how you drive. And maybe it's an innocent amount of tension, it's not very much. But then you notice that when you're parking your car, there's a little bit of tension about the right parking slot. And you feel a little bit, you see someone else maybe is going to get that slot, and you feel you get a little bit tight. Or you're driving on the freeway and someone, you know, cuts you off a little bit and you get irritated and then the irritation lingers. There's a lot of small stresses that go on in life. And if we're not mindful in tracking them, what happens is they often accumulate. They don't just kind of vanish just quickly. They accumulate. And a lot of people get exhausted by the end of the day by this small accumulation of stress that builds up. By being mindful through the day, we tend not to, it tends not to build up. It tends to settle down or it tends not to, you know, accumulate as quickly. Which means that when you go to meditate, you're in a better place to meditate. So practicing daily life supports meditation practice. Meditation practice supports mindfulness in daily life. Makes some sense? So that's one whole way of developing the practice, is to begin exploring, experimenting with how to bring it into daily life. It can be really fun to do. If it's not fun or enjoyable or meaningful, if it's a duty, don't do it. Don't do it because it's an obligation. That's not Buddhism. Then the other way of developing mindfulness is to develop it with greater concentration. If you have, if you take a telescope and you're going to look, you know, some big long telescope and you're going to look at the moon, or some object far in the distance, you can't really hold it still enough to really, you know, see well. And so you put it on a tripod, and the stability of the tripod allows you to see, you know, much better. Same thing with the mind. The mind needs a tripod. The mind needs stability so it can see really well. And the function of concentration is to help create that stability. So you can be kind of mindful all the time, but the mind is kind of jumping around a lot. And because it's jumping around a lot, it can't really hone in or settle in or see something very, really clearly. So one of the things we often do is develop concentration. There's two ways of developing concentration. One is to focus only on breath meditation for a while. If you only do breath, forget everything else, stay with the breath. That tends to train the mind to get concentrated, to settle down. So if you find yourself, your mind is way too agitated, just jumping around a lot in meditation, try just forget about all the other instructions, just stay on the breath until the mind calms down. The other way of developing concentration is to go on a meditation retreat where you have a chance to practice meditation, mindfulness meditation, for a longer period of time through the day. The meditation retreats we teach are silent retreats so that you have the added benefit of being not being involved in social conversation and work and the usual activities of life. And that helps the mind become concentrated or still or settled or become more stable. And it's one of the beautiful things to do in life is to go off and do a spiritual retreat. Maybe some of you have done it. There's many different kinds of spiritual retreats. I think they're great to step out of our normal life. And when you step out of our normal life, we have a chance to see ourselves and see our life in new ways. I've been told there's a saying in England that you don't know England until you've left England. So you don't know your own culture until you stepped out of your culture and looked back. And so there's something about a spiritual retreat where you can really step out of your ordinary life that allows you to see and understand yourself in a deeper way. On the silent retreats, meditation retreats, it allows that process to work further and allows for a stronger stability of mind to settle in, to develop over time. And as that deeper concentration, subtleness, and focus happens, then the mindfulness becomes much more incisive, much more penetrating, and we see much more deeply in the deeper operating system, the deeper issues that are going on, and we learn to resolve and settle and dissolve some of the deeper things that are influencing our lives, but we seldom have a chance to see and address. So here at IMC, we do one-day retreats you're welcome to come to. We also put on residential retreats, overnight retreats that people can do. You're welcome to join us. Spirit Rock, which is a meditation center that's connected to us, teaches the same practice I'm teaching you here. Up in Marin County, they have retreats throughout the year, and it's a wonderful place to practice. And it's a beautiful thing to do. Some of you might be interested in it. So I said that to do those two things, to practice in daily life and to practice in, you know, developing more concentration, retreats or whatever, is a vehicle for developing insight or wisdom, to see more clearly what's going on here. And a lot of that in Buddhism means to begin seeing our life freed of the usual concepts, ideas that we're often limited by because we see our life through these concepts and ideas. So I want to give you an example, of hopefully simple example, of how when the mind gets calm, settled, and can see clearly, it can see through or around the concepts we often live by, and then because we're no longer caught up in those concepts, there's a chance for us to settle down, to relax, to see more wisely and relate more wisely to what's going on. So I'm going to hold up a leaf. So it's a simple leaf. And holding up this leaf, it's just a leaf. You know, it's a little bit pale green. It's elongated. Just a leaf in and of itself, just a leaf. The leafness of the leaf. Just that's, you know, nothing. But now, I can hold up this leaf in my right hand, and now I can say something new that I couldn't say before. Now I can say the first leaf is the small leaf, and the second leaf is the big leaf. Right? Small, big. Small, big. Right? You see that, right? Now I'm going to do magic right in front of your eyes, and I'll even you'll see how the hand trick works. Okay? Small, big, right? Isn't that amazing? you see how that was done? Yeah, how did I do that? so now the one that was big before, the one that was small before is now the big one. And the other one is small. This one is small, right? So what this means is that small and big does not reside in the leaf. The leaf itself is neither small nor big. The leaf by itself is just a leaf. In Buddhism we say the thusness of the leaf, thusness of things. Things are just thus, they're such. The big and small resides in the comparison to other things. And it's arbitrary, you can compare it to different things. A lot of human suffering arises because of comparisons, not because how things are in and of themselves. So if I tell you that I'm a really lousy basketball player, and you should feel sorry for me, or I'm a really good basketball player, and you should kind of praise me, the right thing to ask, I think, is compared to who? And if I say, you know, I'm a hotshot basketball player, really good, and he says, well, compared to who? Oh, that's a seventh grader, that the 7-year-old next door to my, you know, my neighbor. You know, that puts it in perspective what I think of myself, right? Or if I say I'm a lousy basketball player, you know, and I compare myself to, you know, one of the best players on the LA Lakers, you know, that's kind of silly, right? You know, compare myself that way. So we compare ourselves, and we compare ourselves in many ways. We compare ourselves because of our bodies, tall, short, long hair, short hair, lots of hair, no hair, noses, butts, legs, you know, sizes. And, you know, and so much of the suffering happens when we do the comparisons. If you sit and close your eyes and experience your body in its suchness, as it is in itself, free of those comparisons, it's usually just fine. It doesn't matter. It's just what it is. And then you can watch the creation of the concepts and ideas of comparisons. And those comparisons are not inherent, but they're relative. They arise. They're conditioned. Many times we latch on to those comparisons and we see our life and see the world through the filter of those ideas. But that's only, it's a very limited idea. They have their place, those comparisons, but that's not the only game in town. It's possible to see it as a concept, a comparison, an idea, and just leave it alone. It's a big leaf, so what? It's not better or worse. It's a big leaf compared to the other leaf. But it's just a leaf. I can see it as big or small. Just let it be. And so as the mind gets calm and settled and starts seeing more clearly, one of the things it can see, the wisdom it can have, is to watch how the mind does the magic trick. How the mind creates these ideas, and we start living as if those ideas are the truth. And unfortunately, we suffer a lot because of it. But if we're mindful and calm, and we can watch the production of these thoughts, we can see it as a thought, as an idea, as a concept, then we have a half a chance, or a good chance, of not buying into it, not being pushed around by it, not latching onto it, leaving it alone. If we latch onto it, chances are your mind's going to get agitated. It's going to get contracted. It's going to get tight. And so part of the function of relaxation and meditation is to help loosen the contractions, the tightness around these thoughts and ideas that often drive our lives. So they're not in the driver's seat anymore. They have their place, but we can be wise about when we use them and when we don't, or how we relate to them. Does that make some sense? So the wisdom part of Buddhism, the insight part, has many different aspects to it. And I gave you a taste of one aspect here with this idea of concepts and comparisons. And so perhaps you can get a sense of how sitting in meditation and mindful can help you slowly perhaps free yourselves from the grip that these things can have on our lives and ourselves. And if we see the world without these concepts predominating, things are much more vibrant and fresh and beautiful, usually. So I've talked for quite a while, so now it's your turn. Do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make of what I said about all this?
What is walking meditation?
Sorry?
What is walking meditation?
Oh, what is walking meditation? So there are mindfulness in our tradition is usually done in two primary forms, seated meditation and walking meditation. Both of them involve being mindful of what you're doing, whereas in seated meditation, the primary focus is the breath. In walking meditation, the primary focus is the alternating sensations of the foot that's doing the stepping. So we just keep there. So sitting meditation is the rhythm of breathing in and out. In walking, it's the rhythm of the feet stepping. You can do it in bare feet or shoes, it doesn't matter. Some people like to do it in bare feet, but there's more sensations, it's more compelling. And then the mind wanders off, and you come back. Or if there's strong sensation, feelings or thoughts, you might stop the walking, close your eyes, and then do mindfulness of the emotions or the thoughts until they pass, and then you begin walking again. It's a beautiful practice to do. And one of the nice things about walking meditation is that it's closer to how people live their ordinary lives. Most of us do a lot of, some walking through the day, whereas most of us don't sit around with our eyes closed much during daily life. So by practicing mindfulness of walking, it tends to bridge or make it easier to learn how to bring mindfulness in daily life. And there's a handout. I don't know if you picked it. Yeah, go ahead. Yes?
I've only been doing this less than 2 weeks, What I find is I can pay attention to a couple breaths and then relax into it kind of internally, and then I get this zing of adrenaline that will run through my stomach, and it's just a repeated pattern.
Interesting.
Is that a normal thing?
So are you intentionally relaxing, or are you just relaxing is what's happening as you tune into a couple of breaths?
Relaxing is what's happening.
Okay,
so but as soon as I do, I seem to become aware that I'm relaxing, and then I get that adrenaline.
Okay, rush. So yeah, so I can well imagine that happens sometimes to some people. I don't know why it's happening for you, but I would be relaxed about it and be very patient. And it might take a while, a few months, for something to work itself out and relax so that zing doesn't happen. I don't know about you, but I mentioned this earlier. Sometimes, like I mentioned earlier today, sometimes even just a little bit of relaxing, there's stuff under the surface that's just waiting to show itself. There's tension that's just waiting to be released. And sometimes it releases very fast. And adrenaline usually associated with fear. So it could be that there's some reservoir of fear that's not so far from the surface for you. And just a couple of breaths is enough to, any kind of relaxation shows it up. So I would be very gentle and patient, and don't push it and don't worry about it, and just kind of just keep doing it. Let the zing happen. Do feel what's there, and then go back to your breath. That when you're ready, let the zing happen. Just do it. And the more, unless you get more anxious doing it, probably what will happen is that slowly you'll get you relax more and more about this zing happening, and then something will resolve itself. As you continue with it, you might also slowly become aware of some of the different aspects of what's going on. There might be an emotion that's connected to it. And so if you at some point recognize the emotion, then you might want to explore that emotion for a while. So that's how does that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. Yes, maybe.
So working with my thoughts, I find that I'm still struggling with that. What tends to happen is the image will come up, and that's my thoughts tend to be images. And so the progress I'm making is that I can try to observe it rather than getting caught up in it. But what happens is I'm holding this image at bay, kind of, and then it morphs with this very fast sort of set of free association into a different image, a different image, a different image. And by the 10th image, I've been exhausted by it, and then I just let myself I'm caught up in that thought.
I see. So you can stay mindful for a while, but it's a lot of work to not get pulled into it.
Yeah.
So how about if you just recognize the first image a little bit, step back, observe that's what's going on, and then switch your attention away from seeing to your breathing. Can you do that? Because it sounds like you're kind of holding it at bay.
Yeah.
And so rather than holding it at bay, perhaps you can relax into your breathing, and maybe that'll just keep it from popping up so readily. The other thing you can do, if your images or your thoughts are happening so rapidly and with such force that you have to feel you really have to keep them at bay, then there's something really interesting to discover there. So I get really curious. What's going on with your thinking, with your imaging? What's driving them? What's the force? What's the energy? What's the emotions that are behind them? What are the beliefs behind them? What's the nature of those images? It's something you can learn there. Because, you know, it's not so useful to always be holding things at bay. In fact, if you keep doing it and you don't learn anything about the images, then you want to bring mindfulness to your feeling of struggle. And maybe that's the key for you. Maybe you have, I don't know you, but right? But maybe, I know some people, their way of operating, the way they believe life's a battle, and they always have to struggle. And so that whatever they do, they're always kind of, and there's, with thinking, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you think you have to struggle with your thoughts, that very struggle agitates the mind and produces more thoughts. So first I would encourage you to get curious and to explore the world of your thoughts. See what you can learn there, what needs to be settled, what needs to relax there. And if that doesn't show anything, then I would turn your attention to being a student of your struggle and see what's going on there. Is that okay?
Yeah, thanks.
So speaking of images, it reminds me that, when I focus on my breath, I see an image like an expanding and contracting or whatever, but I see it as an image like over and over and over, and then it sort of lulls me. So I'm just open to suggestions.
Yeah. So when you're with your breathing, and then you see an image, then clearly note seeing. Be aware, step back and be really aware. Here's a human being who's looking. So you're not caught, involved in the seeing. Just kind of step back. Because then it's the getting involved in it, which is probably lulling. So if you step back, here I am again, looking, seeing. Step back. And that might free you from it. And once you free a little bit from it, see if you can intentionally let the mind's gaze go to the actual physical sensations of breathing. Turn away from it. And be very careful about lulling yourself. Because people often associate meditation with calming, and it's one of the functions of meditation is to get calm, some people are soothing themselves too much in meditation. And if you soothe yourself too much in meditation, you'll fall asleep. So.
Thanks.
Okay. So a couple of things to say before we end here. It's very helpful to, from time to time, to meditate with other people. Sometimes it's hard to keep the motivation going when you're alone. But also sometimes when you meditate alone, sometimes when you meditate occasionally with other people, we learn something about meditation almost by osmosis, by being in the room with people. And so it's time to time. So there's many sitting groups all over the peninsula, all over the Bay Area now. It's in Mountain View. There's Shyla Catherine has a great sitting group down there. And Tuesday night in San Jose, there's Wednesday night. There's, in Half Moon Bay, there's Wednesday evening. And so a variety of different places. And there's different, there's Zen sitting groups, there's Tibetan sitting groups, and if there's no sitting groups close enough that works for you, then maybe go Sunday morning, go sit with the Quakers. They sit in silence, and usually, mostly, and they don't mind if you sit there and meditate in silence with them. But just it's nice to be in silence with people. And you're welcome to come here. We have a full schedule of sittings through the week, Sunday morning, Monday evening, Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning, Thursday morning. So we have one-day sittings, retreats on Saturdays, once a month at least. And you're always welcome to come here. By now I hope you've understood that IMC is meant to be a little bit of an informal place where it's relatively easy and welcoming to come. Easy come, easy go. Nothing's really asked of you except please, it'd be nice if you turned off your cell phones before you came and meditated. But please feel free to participate here if you'd like. There's a variety of things. The Thursday, the meditation is shorter. I think it's half an hour meditation, so it's usually nicer for beginners. Sunday tends to be the bigger group, and sometimes it's the more social group if you want to meet people, because we have potlucks on Sunday once a month. And Sunday morning, people are more relaxed afterwards. They linger around. So feel free to come to our retreats. And as I think those of you who are here at the beginning heard this, but all the offerings here at IMC are offered freely. There's no charge for anything we do here. And that's kind of our religious kind of approach to the practice, is to offer it as a gift, offer it freely. Those of you who would like to support the teachers who teach here, myself today, or our operations, the building, the lights and everything that makes us work here, then there's this box by the door, and we're very grateful for the people that support us. It's quite phenomenal that all these years we've had this business model. People told us it wouldn't work. You can't just, but it's worked very well for us, and very happy to do it this way. And I just want to thank you all for your interest and your involvement in this course. And please, would like all of you to feel very welcome to come back anytime you'd like to come here and use this resource of this place. So thank you all very much.